And welcome to the reading of the Gazette for Friday, July 31st. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. When we turn to the front page, there's an article titled, Wadena Had Whole Lot of Shaking Going On. Famous Acts Drew Hippies 50 Years Ago to Iowa, by Mike Hlass. There was no documentary made about it. If there is a recording compiling all of its performances, it's a well-kept secret. Yet the Wadena Rock Festival did indeed happen 50 years ago in northeast Iowa. It was even voted the number one story in Iowa that year. About 40,000 people came from near and far to a 220-acre farm 2 miles west of Wadena for the July 31st through August 2nd, 1970 event, featuring 30 musical acts. Some were regional, others were nationally known. Some were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame decades later. Even then, Governor Robert Ray made an appearance, telling the crowd to have a good time. But unlike the massive and well-documented Woodstock Rock Festival of the year before in upstate New York, if you weren't at Wadena, you pretty much have to rely on the memories of those who were, or those who had connections to it, to relive that summer weekend. Now, a half century later, here are some of the accounts. I was a month away from getting my driver's license, said Doug Schoon of Iowa City, who grew up in Monticello. That Saturday, my parents and some of their friends, they would have been in their early 40s, decided to go to Wadena. Of course, that got my curiosity up, knowing they were going there. There must be something exciting. My family ran a farm equipment and auto dealership, and I had to keep the business open until 1 o'clock. Then I just decided, even though I didn't have a driver's license, I'd just drive up on my own. I'd probably been driving illegally for a number of years anyway. I don't know how I found out about this, but there was a field that you could go in the back way to this thing and sneak in. It was almost like a pathway through this field had been made for people sneaking into the rock concert. It took you through some timber area and then down across a creek. Once you got by the farmer's fence, you crossed this creek area, and that's when you started seeing what was taking place. Between smoking marijuana, drinking, and literally laying in the creek, you had people having sex. For a 16-year-old, it was a rude awakening to the rock world. Unquote. Kurt Langle of Marion grew up in Olwine, a rock music lover who went on to play in several bands. He was 12 then, too, and much too young to go to Wadena. But he remembers that weekend. I was pretty impressionable back then, Langle said. What I remember is working at my dad's service station, Langle's Standard Service on Highway 3rd East in Olwine, and kind of seeing the cast of characters come piling out of the vans. And just, you know, my dad's reaction in general. It was a hippie generation, and my dad had been around a while and wasn't into the long hair. He wasn't into the flower children. A lot of head shaking, Langle said with a laugh about his father's reaction to the visitors to Fayette County. I pumped a lot of gas and sold a lot of cigarettes and candy, and I cleaned the bathrooms a lot. I remember that. I've got to tell you, unless I'm mistaken, we really didn't have any issues. My dad said, watch everybody real close. So I was watching everybody real close. He was too, but I remember them being very friendly and polite. They just looked a lot different. Tony Aylesworth is the superintendent of schools in Pleasantville. He is from Wadena, but wasn't yet born when the Wadena Festival occurred. His grandfather, however, may have prevented the event from a premature end. 5 generations of my family have been in the house moving business in Wadena, and my cousin still runs it, Aylesworth said. I was told that at one point the corner of the stage at the concert had started to sag and they needed equipment to raise it up. My grandfather was very conservative. He wore bib overalls everywhere, and here he was going out among that crowd to help set the stage back up. He did, and they hadn't handed him a sack full of cash for his trouble. Bill Ramsey, a Muscatine realtor, grew up in Olwine. He lived 5 miles from the festival, but didn't attend because, quote, I was 13, and most of the publicity for it was a hippie festival with weed and LSD and all that kind of stuff, so my parents kept a tight leash on me. But I was directly exposed to thousands of people that were coming through on their way here. I heard the music from afar, and I saw the aftermath. I've been infatuated with the whole rock festival, though I didn't have the opportunity to be on the site. Forever curious about the event, Ramsey collected photos and clippings about it and researched who actually performed there and who didn't. He made a 37-minute video that's on YouTube with recordings and photos of many of the artists who were there that weekend. There were all these planes with a lot of reporters and stuff, aerial pictures of the grounds and so forth. I've seen news reports that said at one time or another there were 13 to 20 airplanes circling the grounds. A friend of mine was kind of an assistant at the Olwine Municipal Airport. One act, a singer-musician, was Buffy St. Marie. She flew into the airport and they just kind of had her hanging out there, and then a helicopter took her to the stage. She performed and then came back. This friend of mine was awestruck and said he'd been a Buffy St. Marie fan ever since. James Ronan of Decorah has had a career in broadcasting, promoting music events. In 1970, he was an enterprising 18-year-old. He had thought about driving to Galena, Illinois for the festival before it was moved to Wadena a week before the event began. A friend of mine at the time, we were both just out of high school. His mom worked at the newspaper here, Ronan said. She got him a press pass to cover the stock car races here. Galena was kind of a ways away, and we didn't know much about Galena, and all of a sudden, when it switched from Galena to Wadena, we were going. So I said to my friend, Craig, you already have a press pass for the races. Why don't you try to get me as a photographer? We'll go down to Wadena and cover it. So he got me that, and we went down there, and here we were, a couple of teenagers with press passes, and they welcomed us. We went down on Tuesday and checked it out. Then Craig and I were at the drive-in movie theater here that Thursday night, and after the movie got over with, we just drove down to Wadena. We had camping, and we had everything covered, so we got down there after midnight on Friday morning, and it got all set up. The music began Friday afternoon and was supposed to end at midnight. Oh, no. It was about midnight, and things had gone just fine. Everybody's kind of getting ready for the next day, so after midnight, who comes out? Blues and rock guitarist and singer Johnny Winter plays. It was just incredible. You could hear his music 10, 15 miles down the valley. The headline was, Cows Gave No Milk, Chickens Laid No Eggs. And after that, we thought we'd crash till noon. Well, then came the most distinctive anything of the whole weekend. 3 in the morning, give or take, all the lights come on the stage. And standing on top of a grand piano is Little Richard. He's wearing a mirrored blue suit, so all the lights on him are coming back. He's there saying, I'm the emancipator. I'm the originator. I'm the real king and queen of rock and roll. I think he was on stage darn near till the sun came up. On page 2, we have the COVID report. 10 COVID-19 deaths, 649 new cases reported in Iowa. Linn County reports 43 new cases, Johnson 34. Hospitalizations decline, by Alexandra Skoris. 10 additional COVID-19 deaths and 649 new coronavirus cases were reported in Iowa as of 11 a.m. Thursday, when the Gazette updates the previous 24-hour period. The number of deaths was the most reported in the past 2 weeks, bringing the statewide death toll to 854 since mid-March. Jackson County in eastern Iowa reported its first coronavirus-related death, bringing the total number of Iowa counties reporting fatalities to 72. The number of coronavirus cases in Iowa now total 43,844 since mid-March. The new cases reported Thursday, 649, came from the 5,023 tests for a positive rate of 11.44%. Linn County reported 43 new cases, for a total of 1,937 since the pandemic arrived. The 7-day rolling average of new cases in Linn County is now 36, tying the previous highest average. Johnson County reported 34 new cases for a total of 1,835. The county's rolling 7-day average is 22. Polk County reported 136 new cases, the most new cases reported in the state. Linn's 43 new cases was in second place, and Johnson's 34 was in third place in the state. Prairie Ridge Care Center in Sioux County was added to the list of long-term care facilities reporting outbreaks. Statewide hospitalizations were 237, down from 248. The number of patients in intensive care remained at 76. The number of patients on ventilators ticked down from 32 to 31. The Iowa counties with 50 or more coronavirus cases reporting the highest percentage increases in new cases are Franklin, 7.3%, Madison, 5.7%, Cedar, 4.5%, Fayette, 4.2%, and Sac, 3.9%. Another article on page 2 is titled, Physicians Call for Masks as Pandemic Public Health Strategy, by Alexandra Skoras. The Iowa chapter of the American College of Physicians said Thursday it sent a statement to Governor Kim Reynolds calling for masks to be worn in community settings to slow the spread of coronavirus. The National Organization of Specialists within Primary Care stated the pandemic has been extraordinary and noted the rate of infection climbs and noted the rate of infection continues to climb in Iowa. The statement said masks should be worn when physical distancing is not possible. The college's members believe that authorities should make masking comprehensive public health strategy, which should include masking, good hand hygiene, approved disinfection practices, social distancing, and effective testing. On Wednesday, 300 Iowa doctors signed a letter urging Reynolds to issue a mask mandate. On page 3, Iowa City Police Chief Finalists Announced, by Larry Hermiston. Three men are in the running to serve as Iowa City's next police chief. City Manager Jeff Fruin said in a news release Thursday, the finalists are Commander Jason Lando of the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police, Lieutenant Dustin Liston of the El Paso, Texas Police Department, and Olwine Police Chief Jeremy Logan. They say they saw a great opportunity here in Iowa City, Fruin told the Gazette. They want to be actively a part of the community discussion that's happening right now. Lando has been with the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police since 2000 and commander since 2014. He has a bachelor's degree in emergency medicine management from the University of Pittsburgh and a master's degree in legal studies from California University of Pennsylvania. Liston is a 1997 graduate of the University of Iowa with a bachelor's degree in psychology and sociology. The following year, he was hired by the El Paso Police Department and was promoted to lieutenant in 2014. He earned a master's degree in criminal justice from the Sewell Ross State University in 2016. Logan has been with the Olwine Police Department since 1993 and has served as chief since 2002. He has a bachelor's degree in applied science in criminal justice administration from Waldorf University and is enrolled in the Criminal Justice Leadership Master's Program at Waldorf. Fruin said 18 people applied for the position. Semi-finalists were interviewed by a committee, but Fruin selected the finalists. Whoever is selected will join a department that could see changes in coming months. The City Council has committed to restructuring the police department. City Council members have said they want a police chief who sees that process as an opportunity. Fruin agrees. That was really important to me, Fruin said. I think all three candidates demonstrated a very good understanding of where we're at as a community and what we expect from the police department. Fruin said details of a public meet and greet event with the chief candidates will be announced later. The event will include COVID-19 protocols and be broadcast for those unable to attend. The public is encouraged to offer feedback by emailing policechiefsearch, all one word, at iowacity.org, or sending written feedback to the Human Resources Administrator at 410 East Washington Street, or using the City Hall lobby drop box. Also on page 3, Iowa City offers plan to restart school culture at Lucas. Some teachers and staff are reassigned, and the support is extended to the principal, by Grace King. The Iowa City Community School District will be transferring several teachers and staff at Lucas Elementary and providing professional development following an investigation into the school's culture and climate. The investigation was launched after staff, parents, and community members contacted the district and school board members about concerns that Principal Kathy Jenkins, a Black woman, was being treated unfairly by staff and parents. The investigation was conducted by Encompass Resolution, which investigates workplace complaints and offers workplace training and dispute resolution. I think this report should provoke each of us to examine how we're contributing to a negative climate at times, Interim Superintendent Matt Degner said during an Iowa City School Board meeting this week. I believe no one escapes blame in a situation like this. Those that suffer the most from something like this is our students. As a district, we need to do better. The district is taking the following initial steps to restart that culture, Degner said. Point one, transferring and reassigning several teachers and staff members at Lucas Elementary, which is at 830 South Lawn Drive. Two, working with Jenkins to identify ways the district can support and assist her success at Lucas. Three, providing professional learning to the school community, including culturally proficient teaching and restorative practices. There's a lot of details and a lot of work that will go into these three different pieces, but we feel like those are critical steps necessary to improve the experience for our students, Degner said. Degner said the investigation called into question the district's ability to, quote, support a successful Black leader and her experience, unquote. If we don't have a foundational culture that can lead to success, what we do around that culture will have limited return, Degner said. We have to create equitable, inclusive school environments. We do support Dr. Jenkins and her leadership at Lucas. We're committed to her and a successful start to the school year. According to the investigation, leadership style and communication were the primary staff concerns, as well as cliques or factions among staff members. The investigation concluded some of the negative climate and culture issues. The investigation concluded some of the negative climate and culture issues predated Jenkins being named Lucas principal in the fall of 2018. It also stated that Jenkins believes the resistance she has experienced from staff and some parents, including the parent-teacher organization, is caused by conscious or unconscious bias related to race. J.P. Clausen, a school board member, said he hopes the investigation leads the district to explore other areas with similar cultural concerns. Board member Charlie Eastham said he hopes the board and administration learn from the experience and strive not to let it happen in the future. Personally, I viewed this as a learning experience for me to understand how to respond to instances where a Black leader in the district has not been treated well at all, Eastham said. And from the Insight page, we have the Gazette's editorial titled A Bipartisan Win. Major conservation legislation has cleared Congress with the support of Republican Iowa U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst and Democratic U.S. Representatives Abby Finkenauer, Dave Loebsack, and Cindy Axne. It's a welcome and notable bipartisan achievement in our sharply divided and partisan times. The Great American Outdoors Act passed the Senate by 73-25 and the House by 310-70. President Donald Trump has said he would sign the legislation, which permanently funds the Land and Water Conservation Fund with $900 million annually. The money comes from oil and gas royalties. The bill provides a guaranteed funding stream for the development and upkeep of outdoor recreational and wildlife areas, as well as resources to protect endangered species and environmentally sensitive forests. National parks also would receive $1.9 billion annually for the next 5 years to address a $12 billion backlog of needed repairs. Enacting this historic law will protect treasured spaces and places in every state in the nation for people of all ages to enjoy for years to come, Grassley said in a news release. In Iowa, according to Grassley, money for national park repairs will provide funding for federal attractions and wildlife areas in Iowa. The Pew Charitable Trusts estimates that the Herbert Hoover National Historic Site in West Branch has $3.2 million in deferred maintenance needs, and the Effigy Mounds National Monument near Harper's Ferry has $2.3 million. National wildlife areas in Iowa, including the Driftless Area National Wildlife Refuge near Elkader and the Upper Mississippi National Wildlife and Fish Refuge, stretching through 6 eastern Iowa counties, are among the areas that could tap the money. Outdoor recreation in Iowa, according to Grassley's statement, generates $8.7 billion in economic activity while supporting 83,000 jobs. Amid the coronavirus pandemic, many Iowans distancing from indoor gatherings have discovered or rediscovered the state's outdoor recreation areas. When I sign it into law, it will be historic for our beautiful public lands, Trump tweeted back in March in support of the bill. It's a welcome reversal after his original budget called for 97% cut in Land and Water Conservation Fund budget. The Great American Outdoors Act is fresh evidence that Congress can still come together to accomplish far-reaching legislation with bipartisan support, even amid the partisan warfare of an election year. We hope it's a trend, not an anomaly. Now we have Adam Sullivan's column, At Liberty. It's titled, Iowa's Third Party Taking on Racists. As the nation grapples with complicated issues of racial justice, so too is Iowa's third largest political party. The Libertarian Party is facing an internal crisis over how to respond to Black Lives Matter protests. In that, the Liberty Movement has an opportunity to root out reactionaries and recast itself as a solidly anti-racist movement. The debacle started this month when Libertarian presidential nominee Joe Jorgensen made a hashtag Black Lives Matter post on Twitter. Quote, it is not enough to be passively not racist, we must be actively anti-racist, unquote. The message struck me as uncontroversial, but I was naive, because the tweet set off a hostile reaction from supposed libertarians. They accused the candidate of siding with the Black Lives Matter organization, which they see as Marxist. The discourse took an ugly turn last weekend when a libertarian activist was shot and killed while supporting a Black Lives Matter gathering in Texas. Garrett Foster was legally carrying an AK-47 and accompanied his girlfriend, a Black woman who uses a wheelchair. According to news reports, Foster did not fire his weapon before he was shot by someone in a vehicle. Foster should be a hero to liberty activists, a gun owner attending a protest against police violence. But to some, he apparently deserved to die because he was guilty of wrongthink standing in the street. Libertarians are supposed to oppose state violence, but some are cheering for more aggressive police crackdown on protesters and riots. That instinct is aptly depicted in a meme spoofing the, quote, don't tread on me, quote, flag with an alternative tagline, which reads, "Tread on them, I mostly disagree with their politics." Toy A.S. Johnson, Libertarian, Senate District. Toya S. Johnson, a Libertarian candidate for Senate District 16 this year, has been involved in both Libertarian politics and racial justice activism for several years. She sees plenty of overlap between the two movements' concerns: disparities in the family law system, drug prohibition, incarceration, and over-policing to generate revenue, to name a few. "We don't want to see the same things. We want to see the system treat people fairly." "We want to see the same things. We want to see the system treat people fairly. We want to see people recognize that the Constitution applies to everyone," said Johnson, who in 2018 became the first Black woman to get on the ballot for State House as a Libertarian. Libertarianism is not a racist ideology, but we can't ignore the fact that it sometimes attracts racists. So the party has a choice to make: coddle the bigots to maintain their support, or call out their crap and speak the truth. Iowa libertarians are choosing the latter. Libertarian Party of Iowa leaders are not backing down from their support for Black Lives Matter demonstrations. Their Facebook page features a constant stream of posts decrying police overreach and pointing out the hypocrisy of libertarians' detractors, even as angry Facebook users bash them. Black Lives Matter, and libertarians should say so frequently and loudly. A crisis like this is a powerful opportunity to change minds. I was able to learn, and I've been learning ever since George Floyd's murder, and there's still a lot I need to learn. It's definitely been eye-opening for me. I was once a neocon, and here I am talking about leaning more toward the anarchists, said Mike Connor, Libertarian Party of Iowa chairman. You are listening to the reading of the Gazette for today, Friday, July 31st, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Charmita Harrison, 91, died Tuesday, July 28th. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids. Janet Louise Moss, 80, died Wednesday, July 29th. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, Cedar Rapids. Donald L. Long from Marion, 87, died Wednesday, July 29th. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Marion. In Ossian, Evelyn Frances Whitkin, 103, died Tuesday, July 28th. Schmitz Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Ossian. Waukon, Donald E. Schwarzkopf, 83, of Waukon, formerly of Dorchester, died Wednesday, July 29th, the Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon. Rick Lee Canny, Cedar Rapids. Rick was born in Osage, Iowa, to Clifford and Mildred and Babe Canny, where he also graduated high school. He was united in marriage to Jean Torgerson on May 22nd, 1971. He was preceded in death by his mother Mildred and his father Clifford. A memorial is being planned for a later date. Carol S. Voss, Cedar Rapids. Carol S. Voss of Cedar Rapids passed away peacefully on Wednesday, July 29th. Private family services will be held on Monday at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Dr. James Coyle, Cedar Memorial Certified Celebrant, will officiate. This service will be live streamed at 11 a.m. Monday, August 3rd, and may be viewed at client.tribucast.com/TCID/514923. Burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. There will be visitation from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people to be allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is encouraged. Jill V. Randall, 46, of Iowa City, died Sunday, July 26th, at home. The family will greet friends from noon to 2 p.m. Friday, August 14th, at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Services in Iowa City. A celebration of Jill's life will begin at 2 p.m. at Lansing's. Masks are very much encouraged. Please respect social distancing guidelines. Instead of flowers and plants, memorials may be directed to Systems Unlimited. William Philip Dusenberry, Washington, Iowa. William Philip Dusenberry, 98, of Washington, passed away on Wednesday, July 29th, at the United Presbyterian Home. A graveside service and interment will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, August 4th, at Elm Grove Cemetery. Memorials have been established for the Shriners Hospital for Children, Knights Templar Eye Foundation, and the Westchester United Methodist Church. Online condolences may be sent for William's family through the web at www.jonesfh.com. Ellen Wills Cuter, Manchester. Eileen Wills Cuter, formerly of Manchester and Dyersville, ended her 11-year journey through the foggy valley of Alzheimer's disease on Wednesday, July 29th, when she passed away at Luther Manor in Dubuque. There is a great comfort in knowing she comprehends again who she is and is with her much-beloved family and friends who preceded her to our Father's heavenly kingdom. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Sunday, August 2nd at Kramer's Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue Monday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. prior to the funeral service. The family would encourage masks to be worn. Please follow the CDC social distancing guidelines. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, August 3rd at St. Francis Basilica in Dyersville with burial in the church cemetery. The Reverend Dennis Quint will officiate. Glenice May Moore, Williamsburg. Glenice May Moore was born December 16, 1939, on the family farm in Davis County, the daughter of Glenn Earl and Edna Maxine Mather Sloniker. Celebration of life service for Glenice will be held at 1 p.m. on Monday, August 3rd at Powell Funeral Home in North English. Burial will be in 16 Cemetery near Wetchere. Visitation will be on Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m. at Powell Funeral Home in North English. A general memorial fund has been established. Messages and tributes may be left at www.powellfuneralhomes.com. Masks are encouraged. Turning to the sports page, Class 5A State Football Softball... Excuse me, Class 5A State Softball Championship. And the headline is No Doubt About It by Jeff Linder. Their roses were red, their new t-shirts are pink, and the Kennedy Cougars are the state's best softball team in Class 5A, without debate. Second-ranked Cedar Rapids Kennedy spliced together a four-run rally in the top of the third inning, and that was more than plenty for pitcher Kaylin Kinney. The Cougars defeated number 1 Fort Dodge 5-1 for the 5A state championship Thursday night at the Rogers Sports Complex. "It's kind of unbelievable," Kennedy coach Madison LeClaire said. "I can't get the smile off my face. We've talked about this for a long time, and now that it's here, it's unreal." Kennedy, 26-1, finished the season with 19 straight victories. The Cougars needed 11 innings to outlast Iowa City Liberty in the regional finals, but once they got to Fort Dodge, they were on a level of their own, winning their three games by a 24-5 margin. "Like LeClaire has told us all year, if we score three of four runs, we can win any game," catcher Abby Spohr said, and that proved again tonight to be true. "It's been a great ride. We knew we were close, and tonight we did it. We got those big roses, the pink championship shirts. That's what we wanted." The title is the first in Kennedy softball history, the first for a Metro team since Cedar Rapids Jefferson went back-to-back in 1979 and 1998. Both teams loaded the bases with no outs in the third inning. Kennedy tallied four runs. Fort Dodge 28-4, settled for 1, and that was the ball game in a nutshell. "When we put runs on the board, we're going to win," said Kinney, who concluded a remarkable 5-year run at Kennedy as the all-tournament captain. Addie Parker opened Kennedy's defining rally with a double. Then Kinney, intentionally, and Maya Dodge, traditionally, drew walks to fill the bases. Spohr laced a liner to left field. Parker scored easily. And when Dodge overran second base, it forced Kinney to make a break for it from third. Kinney scored. Dodge made it back safely, and Kennedy led 2-0. The Cougars added a run on Izzy Wright's groundout and another on Sam Scheck's single for a 4-0 advantage. Spohr, Dodge, and Scheck joined Kinney on the all-tournament team. Fort Dodge got within 4-1 in the bottom of the third. Then the Cougars added a run in the fifth when Dodge doubled and Keaton Gerber drove her home with an infield single. Then it was a matter of counting down the outs. The last one came when Abby Spohr threw out Malia Lowry on a steal attempt of third base. Spohr is the daughter of Julie Farrell Spohr, who won a state championship as left fielder for Webster City in 1988. Kinney, 12-0, held the Dodgers to 3 hits, 2 of which didn't leave the infield. She struck out 9 and walked 1. "At the beginning, I had some nerve," she said, "and then we got some runs, and I was more comfortable." Thursday's joy was a 180-degree turn from Kennedy's state misery of 2019. LeClaire was asked what his team had that made it special. "What don't we have? That's the question," she said. "There's something about this team. They were really in sync. The Cougars had it all. Power hitting, pitching depth, steady defense. And now roses, t-shirts, and a championship." State baseball. Des Moines Christian ousts North Lynn in extra innings. By K.J. Pilcher. North Lynn coach Travis Griffith said he loves his players' toughness. The trait is exactly what propelled them to a thrilling come-from-behind victory earlier this week. It is the same intangible that put them in position to pull out another classic. Unfortunately, it just wasn't enough to finish the job. Six-seeded Des Moines Christian limited second-ranked North Lynn's late rallies and strung together 3 straight hits for 2 runs in the top of the 8th and a 4-2 victory in the Class 2A baseball semifinal last night at Principal Park. The Lions, 17-6, advanced to the title game for the first time, taking on defending champion and top-ranked Van Meter, 22-2, here at 1:30 p.m. Saturday. "We had them on the ropes again for a chance to walk it off," Griffith said. "I love the resiliency of this group. They could have folded the tents 2 or 3 times, and they kept fighting back." Lions starter Trey Castile and North Lynn senior Nathan McEnany were locked in a pitcher's duel, combining to allow just 1 hit through the first 5 innings. Their dramatics began in the 6th inning when the Lions' Ben Lusick led off with a triple to right and scored on a Dalton Lewis double to left. Lewis scored on Colby Shelton's RBI single for a 2-0 lead. Similar to the quarterfinal rally against Durant, the bottom of the order helped answer. Cale Bridgewater and Jaron Payton opened with walks, and Ben Wheatley executed a bunt single to load the bases. Austin Hilmer's fielder's choice pulled the Lynx within 1, heading into the 7th. McEnany reached on an error to start the frame, and Alex Sturbum was hit by a pitch to put the tying and winning run on the base with none out. A fielder's choice moved courtesy runner Jake Van Eaton. A fielder's choice moved courtesy runner Jake Van Eaton to third. North Lynn, which has been a small ball team in the past, went back to one of its old plays, a squeeze play. Bridgewater placed it where no one could find it, according to Van Eaton, and reaching base. Castile buckled down and thwarted both threats, getting strikeouts to end each inning. In the 8th, Shelton and Bradley opened with singles, and Adam Woody delivered an RBI double. Castile sacrificed fly to score. Bradley was some insurance. Castile, 5-2, retired the Lynx in order, thanks to second baseman Zach Ducker, who made a diving catch on a ball that tipped off Bradley's glove that robbed Hilmer of a leadoff single. It also prevented the tying run from coming to the plate. "We have a lot to be proud of," Hilmer said. "We fought those last two innings. The pitcher shut us down through five innings. Those last two innings, we battled. We almost pulled it off. We fought, and that's all you can ask for." Castile followed the two infield singles and struck nine, going the distance. "We haven't seen velocity like that in a long time," Hilmer said. "We didn't have the bats rolling today, and that happens sometimes." Another article from the sports page, "Kinney Cements All-State Legacy with Title," by Jeff Linder. More than anything, Kalen Kinney was thankful for a season that nearly never happened. "That's how I want to be remembered," she said. "Thankful, grateful, somebody that loved the game." One of the best softball players in state history, Kinney completed her resume and her legacy last night. A senior and a University of Nebraska signee, she earned all-tournament captain honors after leading Cedar Rapids Kennedy past Fort Dodge 5-1 in the Class 5A state final at the Rogers Sports Complex. She held a potent Fort Dodge lineup to one run on three hits, striking out nine and walking one. Kinney owns a sunny personality. After all, she wore a sunflower adornment in her hair through much of her career before ditching it this week because she thought it would clash with the pink dye in her hair. But with her pleasantness comes intensity. "She pushed the people when they needed to be pushed," Coach Madison LeClaire said. "But she was here to pick them up when they needed it, too." Close the book on Kinney's Kennedy career with a 67-7 pitching mark, 527 strikeouts and 40 walks, and a .77 ERA. At the plate, she ranks third in the state history with 55 home runs. She did that despite being walked, usually intentionally, 156 times. She was a career .501 hitter with 1.054 slugging percentage. In Kinney's 5 years, the Cougars piled up a 171-24 record, and now a championship. It was a season and a championship that nearly never took root. It wasn't decided until May that there would be a season despite the COVID-19 pandemic. "I'm just happy we got a chance," she said. From the Business 380 page, "Collins is laying off undisclosed number of employees. Second quarter sales down 36% from the same period in 2019, by John Stepp. The Gazette: Collins Aerospace laid off employees from across the country, including many in Iowa, a company spokeswoman confirmed to the Gazette, as the company experiences a decline in sales during coronavirus. Spokeswoman Pam Diverti Cleary declined to state on how many employees are affected. "While we were hopeful the previous cost-cutting steps to align our business with lower levels of commercial demand would be enough, they simply were not," Diverti Cleary said. "This week, we have made the extremely difficult but necessary decision to implement an involuntary separation program across our U.S. operations. Employees laid off will receive a separation payment, transition payment, and continuation of benefits," Diverti Cleary said. Collins Aerospace is a business unit of Raytheon Technologies Corporation. Raytheon Chief Executive Officer Greg Hayes said in a conference call earlier this week that Collins Aerospace is targeting $600 million in cuts and already has cut $300 million, including $90 million since the start of 2020. Diverti Cleary did not immediately comment on how much of those cuts are in the form of job losses. Overall, Collins Aerospace sales were at $4.2 billion in the second quarter, down 36% from the second quarter of 2019. The company also went from $1.3 billion in operating profit in the second quarter of 2019 to $317 million in losses in the second quarter of this year. Neil Mitchell, corporate vice president of Raytheon, said in the earnings call the sales drop was driven primarily by the adverse impacts of COVID-19 on the aerospace industry. Collins Aerospace is the largest employer in Cedar Rapids and has about 10,000 employees in the state. From the Kids Gazette, Superpower by Adam Sullivan. Superheroes are the fictional characters we rely on, saving the world of comic books. They can fly, read minds, and drive around in invisible jets. Some have powers. Others, like Batman, just buy really cool gadgets and use them. But superheroes capture our imagination because in them we can imagine humanity as better versions of ourselves. Here are some fun facts about superheroes and their creators. 1. The creator of Wonder Woman also created the first lie detector test. William Moulton Marston was a con artist and one creative guy. He came up with the idea for the first lie detector test by guessing that people's blood pressure changed when they lied. He was wrong, but his comic book hero, Wonder Woman, lives on. Bruce Wayne, a.k.a. Batman, is named after two real people. His first namesake is Robert the Bruce, who was King of Scots from 1309 to 1329. The other hero is Anthony Wayne, a founder of the United States and a politician whose Hulk-like temper earned him the name Mad Anthony. 3. Captain America was created during World War II. He was created in response to the war. An image of an American super soldier who could defeat all evil. In his biography, Captain America creator Joe Simon said he initially named his hero Super American, but decided against it because the world of superheroes had too many supers. 4. According to the Guinness World Records, the first superhero was the Phantom, who debuted in his own newspaper comic strip on February 17, 1936. The Phantom's name is Kit Walker, and he is a kid who dons a mask to become a working ghost. From page 8, Iowa man gets 40-year sentence for child porn. Federal charges stem from kidnapping sex abuse of 4-year-old girl by Trish Mahaffey. A Council Bluffs man was sentenced to 40 years in federal prison this week for producing and possessing child pornography. Michael Bradstrom, 29, was sentenced Wednesday in U.S. District Court to 360 months for production of child pornography and 120 months for possession of child pornography, sentences that were run consecutively for a total of 480 months. The federal sentence will be served concurrently with his 10-year sentence in Pottawatomie County District Court for third-degree kidnapping and lascivious acts with a child. Bradstrom also was sentenced to serve 15 years of supervised release after prison and pay $10,500 in restitution to numerous victims. The charges stem from an investigation after a mother reported her 4-year-old child missing from their apartment in Council Bluffs on September 2, 2019. As police searched the apartment complex, Bradstrom brought the missing child out to them. According to police, Bradstrom was nervous when they questioned him, and his account wasn't consistent as to why he hadn't contacted police when he located the child. The child's shirt was inside out, police said. The child told authorities that Bradstrom took pictures of her in his bathroom. A search warrant was obtained for Bradstrom's apartment, according to prosecutors, where a laptop and 2 cell phones were found and seized for forensic analysis. The analysis revealed a large number of child pornography images and videos, including those of the child he kidnapped. Investigators also found communications Bradstrom had with children from another country where he attempted to sexually exploit them. The investigation was conducted by the Council Bluffs Police Department and the U.S. Secret Service. The case was prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Pottawatomie County Attorney's Office. 4 men charged in meth trafficking ring by Trish Mahaffey. 4 men were charged this week with methamphetamine trafficking after law enforcement officers obtained 12 search warrants in Waterloo, Cedar Falls, Roland, and Marshalltown. The defendants, Bobby D. Roby, 61, of Ames, Travis C. Workmeister, 33, of Waterloo, and Genaro Aguilar Lemus, 22, of Riverdale, California, and Jorge Martinez Garcia, 28, of Tama, had initial and arraignment hearings in U.S. District Court this week. The indictments, which remain sealed as of Thursday, show they conspired to distribute meth between January 2019 and this month, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. All four pleaded not guilty during hearings and remain in jail pending detention hearings next Tuesday. More information regarding the investigation may be revealed during the detention hearings. If convicted, each faces a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years and possibly up to life in prison, a $10 million fine, and at least 5 years of supervised release following any prison time. This case is being prosecuted by Assistant U.S. Attorney Ashley Corkery. It was investigated as part of the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force program of the U.S. Department of Justice through a cooperative effort of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Iowa Division of Narcotics Enforcement, Tri-County Drug Task Force, Mid-Iowa Drug Task Force, Iowa Counter Drug Task Force, and Central Iowa Drug Task Force. And last, a letter to the editor from Susan Blocker of Cedar Rapids. Senator Ernst should focus on preserving health care options. As a small business owner and cancer survivor, I rely on Obamacare for affordable health care coverage and the assurance I won't be denied health care because of my pre-existing condition. It also ensures my daughter, who just graduated from college, will continue to be covered and that insurance companies can't charge me an exorbitantly high premium just because of my age. It's been extremely stressful then to watch Republicans continually attack the ACA without offering a viable alternative. President Donald Trump's latest move, in the midst of pandemic no less, has been to press the U.S. Supreme Court to strike down the entire law. In light of this, I emailed Senator Joni Ernst to find out what exactly she was doing to assure Iowans will have access to affordable care if the ACA falls. I followed up with a phone call to her office and was told someone would respond to my inquiry. Weeks have passed and still no word from Ernst. In the meantime, she has taken the time to comment publicly on the demonstrations happening in Portland, Oregon, and has breathlessly called for an end to anarchy. Quote, unquote. Lives are hanging in the balance, Senator, and I wish you'd pay as much attention to the real concerns of your constituents as you do to the alarmist, quote, crises manufactured by Trump. And that's by Susan Blocker of Cedar Rapids. And that does it for today's reading of the Gazette for Friday, July 31st. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. check out them checkers. From Dubuque, Don Dweebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers, he told me. I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library. While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers' strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Duber, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training. Don said he unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. It's like the Mona Lisa, Mr. Checker said, of his museum. You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dweebar. If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.